Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The ugly truth about January 6, 2021 is that there is hate and anger all around us. But when that hate is fueled by lies and disinformation, it can spawn violence.
You got to fight the right people.
Yeah, come on.
Boss!
Try
it. I got you, Mike. That's my hand on your gun.
Another truth about January 6th, there was a bit of an intelligence failure leading up to it.
There were indications that these individuals and some of the formalized organizations were talking and planning months before January 6th.
And where did much of that planning take place?
Social media has become so ubiquitous, it's like intravenously feeding misinformation into the national bloodstream.
This week on 880 In Depth, identifying and standing up to extremism in America. Welcome to 880 In Depth. I'm Tim Scheld. Domestic extremism is a serious threat facing our country today. That's the view of Molly Saltzgoog, a senior intelligence analyst for the SUFON Group and research fellow at the SUFON Center. The SUFON Center is a not-for-profit organization dedicated to the study of global and national security. You may recognize the name. It is named for its CEO, Ali SUFON, the former FBI agent, who helped call out missing signs in the months leading up to 9/11. Molly Saltzgoog spoke to our Peter Haskell.
What have we learned about how January 6th happened?
Well, I think we need to start with, in one way, for experts and analysts such as myself, when January 6th happened, it was a shocking event. But at the same time, it was maybe not as surprising as for the general public. We had long, our entity, along with other expert entities and some people in the government, had long been sounding the alarm of the threat that far-right extremism poses to the United States homeland. And January 6th hopefully served as a wake-up call to that. But in terms of what we've learned since, we're still waiting for the special report from Congress to see what really happened that day. Many people have pointed to that there was an intelligence failure, that there were indications that these individuals and some of the formalized organizations were talking and planning months before January 6th, that they were going to travel to Washington, D.C. and storm the Capitol. And many have asked the question, how was this missed?
We hear about some of these organized groups like the Proud Boys and others like it. How much of this do you think was planned? And how much of it was spontaneous, where you've got these thousands of people who were in Washington and just joined the crowd?
Right. That is an incredibly hard question to answer, but we know that the formal organizations like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers were planning, they were fundraising, they were coordinating between each other in their organization and between the organizations at least a month before And that gives you the idea that to some individuals who were there on the ground, it was absolutely a planned action. And you can see that in the way, in the gear that they brought, some of it, you know, resembling military style gear, the way that they moved in formations to enter the Capitol, to break into the Capitol, and the way that they communicated during, before, during, and after the event of the storming of the Capitol.
You talk about this coordination and communication. How does that work? And what kind of role does social media play? I mean, do they use the phone? Do they email? How much of these various methods of communication?
No, that is an excellent question. So for the formalized organizations like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, they use a variety of different mediums to communicate, ranging from Facebook to more encrypted chat applications and forums. And they formally fundraised to travel to Washington, D.C. and so forth. But you bring up the point of social media. And we've done many studies on the what we would call the disinformation and extremism nexus. And there was a, you know, you cannot deny that there were people on the ground that day that were motivated by disinformation about the election, that the election was so-called stolen. And that most of that communication and that disinformation and misinformation was fed to people over social media.
So what do we do about that, if anything? I mean, how do we counter this? Is there a legal strategy? Is there a public relations strategy? How do you deal with this?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, Peter, isn't it? I think that there, I will try to keep my answer relatively short, but because there's so many ways that you can tackle the threat of domestic violent extremism that is facing our country today. But I think at the bottom of, like, at the foundation of it is that we are no longer dealing with, say, 20 years ago, we were dealing with violent extremists and terrorists outside of the United States trying to hurt us. And they were hierarchical, formalized groups. And those tools that we used in the post-9/11 era are no longer applicable. Because the some of these ideologies that are motivating people to commit acts of violence that are politically motivated are actually becoming more mainstream. So we're not talking about the very fringe anymore. And the best approach to that is, you know, education measures, digital and media literacy education, strengthening, again, the faith and belief in our democracy and our institutions. And this is not going to happen overnight. This is now a generational task that lies ahead of us.
Before we move on to some of the things you talked about, I want to ask you one other thing about the insurrection. What do you see as the importance of punishing, prosecuting, and punishing those involved?
Right. So I believe that more than 700 individuals have been charged with federal crimes related to the January 6th insurrection by the Department of Justice. And this is very important because accountability, when we talk about political violence and terrorism and other manifestations of violent extremism, accountability is incredibly important for society to heal. So DOJ has done a tremendous job in sifting through all of the evidence and the materials, and law enforcement, of course, as well, and bringing indictments against these over 700 individuals is a momentous task. But it's also important to note, and this has been a main criticism of the efforts of DOJ, is that there's been complete lack of accountability for any politicians who in any way, shape, or form encourage violence through their rhetoric that day. Actually, we saw yesterday that Secretary Mayorkas of DHS noted the very potent relationship between disinformation and violent extremism in this country. And he specifically mentioned that people in power and leadership, including politicians, are peddling disinformation that actually could lead to violence. And so we're missing that accountability, Peter.
You have written about the fact that the insurrection could serve as a rallying cry for the violent right. How so?
Absolutely. We saw this immediately, actually on the day itself, as these insurrectionists were storming the Capitol. I was watching in real time, monitoring some of the most darkest corners of the internet where a lot of violent white supremacists and other violent far-right extremists are congregating on encrypted chat applications. And they were ecstatic. They were, they were celebrating this attack. And these were not only far-right extremists and white supremacy extremists here, based here in America, but all over Europe and as far away as Australia. And they were talking about this as the beginning of what they hope to be, an overthrow of the democratic system and establishment of a much more authoritarian and perhaps, in some extreme instances, a white ethno state. So it was terrifying to watch, but this happened, as the Capitol was stormed, and we have seen in our research since that it has indeed served as a rallying cry for more and more extreme narratives to become mainstream.
One of the other things that came out from a report that you were involved in is this. Today, domestic terrorism poses the most acute and deadly terrorism threat to the United States. So, two things. One, why is that? And what about foreign terrorism?
Right. This is a great question that oftentimes when we mention this, we become challenged because most people, when you say terrorism, you think of Al-Qaeda or the so-called Islamic State or their ilk. But actually, statistically, domestic violent extremism, as we refer to it here in America, and within that umbrella specifically, far-right violent extremism, white supremacy extremism, and those types of extremism, have actually killed more Americans since 9/11 here on U.S. soil than, say, Islamist extremism. And this is statistics that have been put out by, for example, the ADL and other think tanks that are gathering this information. And we have seen repeatedly that our government agencies have assessed this threat as the most acute and deadly terrorism threat to the United States, the threat of domestic violent extremists. DHS has noted that in several of its assessment reports. The ODNI has noted that in its threat assessment report. And, Secretary Mayorkas of DHS and FBI Director Christopher Wray have also noted that during testimony in front of Congress. So there is statistical and government assessment evidence underlying this claim.
It seems we can't talk about anything these days without talking about COVID. And I'm curious if COVID and lockdowns and mandates and vaccines and all of these things, did they play into this far-right extremism? And if so, how?
No, absolutely. You could view COVID-19 and the pandemic as kind of a catalyst for increased extremist activity. If we focus here on the United States, for example, the very simple logic that a lot of people were isolated and alone and spent most of their time online for a tremendous amount of time during the pandemic. And we talked about this earlier in your program, how social media, a lot of people who showed up at at the Capitol on January 6th were actually motivated by disinformation that they found on social media. And the truth is that today, most users are only a couple of clicks away from potentially radicalizing materials online. And it's very easy to go into that rabbit hole that is promoted by algorithms and clickbait, frankly.
We've seen what happened in Washington, and we've also seen what can happen at state capitals, most notably in Michigan. Heavily armed militia people and others in the state capitals. So I'm curious, are state capitals at risk, and or what do you see as perhaps the next target or kind of target?
The short answer is our democracy, Peter. It's terrifying to say, but what the domestic violent extremism threat, it does pose a lethal threat to Americans and elected officials and so forth in terms of attacks committed and lives lost. We shall not forget the lives lost on January 6th. But also what we were talking about is the erosion of the trust in democratic institutions that many of these extremist narratives promote, and the polarization in our society. But going back to your original question about the, what we would call the militia violent extremists that showed up at some of the state capitals, absolutely, that is assessed as a threat in this year and forward, that those types of groups would pose the biggest risk or threat to elected officials or government personnel and so forth. Meanwhile, if we talk about racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists such as white supremacists and neo-Nazis, they pose the most the biggest threat to your average American conducting violent attacks against, you know, innocent citizens here in America.
Which was part of the motivation for a new book written by our next guest.
My name is Jonathan Greenblatt. I am the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL.
Greenblatt's new book on authoritarianism is called It Could Happen Here. As head of the ADL, which is focused on fighting anti-Semitism, he's concerned with hate wherever it lives. He also spoke with our Peter Haskell.
Put January 6th on a timeline. What led up to it, and what do you see coming after it?
Well, I think it's a good question, Peter. I think January 6th was the culmination of a series of events. I mean, frankly, there's a through line from Charlottesville to Pittsburgh to El Paso to Capitol Hill. The reality is that we've seen an intensification of extremism in several different respects in recent years. Number one, you had the former president who literally invited extremists into the political process in the way we had never seen before. From only finding, quote-unquote, fine people among the neo-Nazis who marched in Charlottesville and murdered a woman, to, you know, asking the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by rather than condemn them on national television, he literally gave them a kind of license. I think number two, extremists feel particularly emboldened in this moment, and we know that because the ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in the world. We've been tracking extremists in this country literally for 100-plus years, and we know they feel emboldened because that's exactly what they are saying. Maybe not out on their Facebook pages or in their Twitter feeds, but in their private chat rooms that we monitor. On the dark web, they're saying, we feel emboldened. And they are now trying to engage in things like school board debates about masking, or engage online about conspiracies around vaccinations. I mean, it's ugly and unfortunate, which then gets to number three. You now have the social media has become so ubiquitous, it's like intravenously feeding misinformation into the national bloodstream. And that misinformation, I should say, Peter, affects people on both sides of the aisle. I don't think people who are Democrats or liberals should imagine for a moment that they're somehow exempt from ignorance or intolerance. The challenge we have today comes from both sides, and it's up to us to engage and push back if we want to preserve this democracy.
You've written a book, It Could Happen Here. What's the it? What could happen here?
Well, I think for me, the it, the unthinkable, is drawn directly from, you know, my background as an American Jew. I'm the grandson of a Jewish refugee, a Holocaust survivor from Germany, who, when he was a young man, never could have imagined that the only country he had ever known and that he loved so much would one day turn on him, regard him as an enemy of the state, destroy everything that he ever loved, and slaughter his entire family and friends. And I'm the husband of a political refugee from Iran, a Jewish woman who heard her family trace their lineage for thousands of years to Iran. And then it was after the Islamic Revolution that they suddenly found that the only country they had ever known turned on them, regarded them as enemies of the state, forced them to flee for their lives and come here to America. So I say this because my own background tells me that the unthinkable, the it, is the disintegration of the social fabric. It is the dissolution of society and the kind of vigilantism and violence that we saw on display on January the 6th. I'm afraid that could move from being the exception to becoming the norm if, again, we don't roll up our sleeves and get ready to engage in a constructive way in preserving the principles that have always made this country great.
The way you describe it, it sounds like almost there's this extremist wave that's washing over us. How do we stop that?
Well, that's literally, Peter, why I wrote the book. Because I do think you could say this is a kind of, you know, a tsunami of toxicity that is rolling over the country. And I think there's several things that we need to do. And the book includes strategies and tactics and tips for what to do when hate happens in the workplace or in the classroom or in a house of worship or literally, you know, in the political arena. So number one, I think we need to call out hate when it happens. We need to interrupt intolerance, particularly when it originates from our side of the political aisle. Again, I don't think either end of the spectrum is exempt from intolerance. I think number two, we need to cancel culture. We need to lose the litmus test. We need to recognize that everyone has the opportunity to be redeemed. I mean, we're all human. We're all fallible. We all make mistakes. The question is, what do we do and how do we learn from them? So I think you've got to give people the opportunity to redeem themselves, not reject them out of hand. And then third and finally, I think we've got to engage. We've got to engage and participate in this democracy. We have to show up at those school board meetings, not to scream, but to employ facts and to push back on the bigots who try to bully us. We've got to get involved in local elections. We've got to vote out the people who would suppress our voting rights and demand that they do things like, for example, hold social media accountable, not allow the most intemperate voices to be amplified, not allow slander to be spread, not allow the companies like Facebook to have no accountability, and instead to demand that they put people over profits. So I think if we engage in our democracy, if we cancel culture, if we call out hate when it happens, these are some of the first steps, I think, to defending this democracy and preserving this incredible experiment that is America.
There have been some surveys released in the past week or so, and they're consistent. Roughly 1 in 3 Americans say violence against the government can be justified. It was 10% 20 years ago. What does this tell you, and what kind of concerns do you have?
Well, I think in many ways it reflects kind of the coarsening of the public conversation. It reflects the embrace of conspiracy theories that people think somehow the government is plotting against them. And it reflects the broader sort of intemperance that seems so common today. I mean, think about here in New York, the ADL, which has been tracking extremists, as I said, for decades and decades, we saw more than 600 extremist activities in the Empire State in 2020, half of which were white supremacist propaganda, saying things like the government is plotting against you. Right? By the way, we saw a rise in hate crimes. We saw 460 some odd hate crimes in New York, a large majority of which were anti-Semitic. So I think we're in a moment where people feel like they've been pushed to the edge, where vigilantism and violence has been validated when the former president tells people to, quote-unquote, liberate Michigan, or tells the mob who broke into the Capitol building, tried to kidnap and kill elected officials, that he, quote-unquote, loves them. That's a real dilemma, and we need responsible officials on the right and the left, Republicans and Democrats, to call out such, you know, illiberalism. It's frightening for all of us when people in positions of authority are encouraging this extremism, and it's got to stop.
Do you think this country could seriously become an autocracy?
Well, look, I believe America is the greatest democracy the world has ever known. I believe that this country has demonstrated extraordinary resilience after civil unrest, after economic depressions, after world wars, and our democracy has always come through. But democracy is a contact sport. It requires us to get involved. You can't watch it from the cheap seats and just expect it will always work. There is no, you know, I believe, preordained natural law that says that this democracy will persist forever if we don't participate in it. So can it slide into absolute authoritarianism? Look, as a Jew, I know that anything is possible. As an American, I hope desperately that we will come through this moment, because the suppression of the vote, laws that would, again, empower vigilantes, this embrace of cancel culture that shuts people off if they commit any transgression, these are all scary trends that we need to stop before they, you know, they spread any further.
You know what I'm curious about? We've got domestic terrorism. We've got anti-Semitism. Is there a link, or is it just an overlap?
Well, I think, look, terrorism, you know, the act of using violence to engender fear among the population, in many ways, anti-Semitism is a kind of terrorism, and always has been, right? People who spread stereotypes and do things like vandalize synagogues or attack Jewish people in broad daylight in Brooklyn, has happened again this weekend. These aren't just crimes against an individual. It's intended often to intimidate a whole community. That is a kind of terrorism. But let's also recognize that, you know, the terrorists who flew the planes into the buildings here in this, you know, fair city on 9/11, or the individuals who murdered people in El Paso, 20-some-odd Latino people, or who shot up the black church in Charleston, those are also acts of domestic terror that weren't targeting toward Jews. I think we find, unfortunately, that anti-Semitism is at the beating heart of the white supremacy, that those white nationalists who talk about, you know, who are racist and anti-Muslim and xenophobic, they often believe there's some anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that they're trying to fight, so it can be hard to disentangle those two things.
Jonathan, fascinating stuff. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate the thoughtful questions.
In Depth is a production of WCBS News Radio 880. Executive producers are Peter Haskell and myself, Tim Scheld. Find us wherever you get your podcast audio. Just search for 880 In Depth and subscribe so you don't miss a week, and listen on your time, on demand. Thank you for listening, and please be safe.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.